It is extremely well done. Although I have to say, it does then have me questioning why she doesn't use this more often, because there's a scene later where he is also standing in front of her with a gun about to shoot her. She could just mentally bite his dick off again. Why
I have
that
in my notes. Why did she not psychically bite his dick again?
Yep.
Because it's like, but so there must be some kind of like mental effort or like preparation. Hello, everybody. Welcome back to another Bald Move Pulp film. We're doing a retrospective on 2012 Dread, the sci-fi action film, and a pretty good one, directed by Pete Travis, with an asterisk note. There's some drama around this. He's a British filmmaker. He also did Vantage Point and A City of Tiny Lights. Screenplay by Alex Garland, who at this point was the writer for 28 Days Later, Sunshine. He went on to direct things that me and Jim have really liked. Ex Machina, Annihilation, Men, which I haven't seen yet. Pretty fucking weird. Weird film, that one. And yeah, the upcoming Civil War. He also did Devs on FX, which I really liked. This is based on the Judge Dredd comics book character, co-created by John Wagner, the writer, and Carlos Ezquiera, the artist. It stars Carl Urban as the man himself, Judge Dredd. You've also seen him in Lord of the Rings, of course, The Boys. He's McCoy on Star Trek. He's joined by Olivia Thirlby, who was in Juno, as well as The Darkest Hour, as well as Wood Harris, who plays a gangster in this movie. You've seen him on Above the Rim, Remember the Titans, and of course, true Bald Move fans will know him as Avon Barksdale from The Wire. And rounding out her cast is Lena Headey, who, you know, Cersei on Game of Thrones. She's also Sarah Connor in The Chronicles, as well as Queen Gorgon? I forget what her exact name is in 300. It's the first time I saw her. Domhnall Gleeson with some interesting early, almost unrecognizable with some early work. He is also General Hux in the shitty Star Wars movies. He was one of the Weasley kids in Harry Potter. Also in Ex Machina and The Revenant. Interesting career this guy's built up. And then Langley Kirkwood, who I only mentioned because he's Axe Hand Morgan on the current One Piece live action series. So if you've seen him there, he plays the corrupt judge. I think his name's Lex in this movie. Whew, Jim, I've seen this movie a bunch.
Uh-huh.
And I love it. Well, this isn't even a first go round for Bald Move. We've never podcasted on it, but we did host a community live watch about 2 years ago during the pandemic. Jim, what do you make of Dread?
Well, we hosted that live watch because this is a badass movie. This is great, man. I mean, in my opinion, this is one of the best action movies of the 2010s. It's like right up there with John Wick and the Fast, you know, 5 through however many they've done now. I can't say enough good stuff about this movie, from the writing to the directing to the effects work. It's super tight. It doesn't overstay its welcome at all. And I love every second of it. I think it's awesome. How about you?
Yeah, especially like the one knock on this movie I've heard is if you saw The Raid that came out the year before.
Sure.
This is a little bit of a retread of that, and maybe the action isn't quite as intense. However,
no, but it has other features. You know, it's not as good as John Wick in like execution, but concept, I think it might even be better.
Yeah, and Dredd is such an interesting character. It's such an interesting world to inhabit.
Mm-hmm.
I love this movie too. This movie, when I look at it, gives me hope that what they're going to try to do with the Warhammer 40K stuff might work, because Judge Dredd is very much cut from the same cloth. It's this wild, crazy, grim, dark world where nothing good ever happens. Its scale is beggars the imagination. It's silly on the face of it, and yet if you try hard enough, you can tell these kind of contained, grounded stories where, you know, it's, I think, you know, and I, this is the first time I've ever watched it with a critical eye, but like, it's interesting that even Dredd goes through a bit of a character development, you know, like he softens his cynicism and his, you know, kind of love of the city and duty, and his sense of justice is a little bit buffed up by his experience with the rookie Anderson.
Mm-hmm.
You know, And there's like this, you know, Carl Urban sells all those moments. And also it just, I really like the Sly Stallone version. You know, I've long thought like there's gotta be
parts
like a 70 minute cut of this movie without Rob Schneider that is actually kind of fucking awesome. And I love how faithful to the comic the costumes were and how kind of Sly, you know, the snarl, like he just excels at that when he bothers to wear the fucking helmet. Urban, though, man, he's just got resting dread face. Like, he never breaks. And sometimes, like, just when you think it's not possible, it'll intensify. The dread face intensifies at especially opportune moments. And it just, it's really fucking fun to watch is what it is.
Yeah, absolutely. And my jaw was dropped by this movie several times because of its effects work. I think the slow-mo effect in this movie is absolutely beautiful. I mean, it's got a lot going on. It's, you know, got some rainbow colors and some sort of flashing and some bokeh effects. But like it just looking at it and thinking about it. I mean, just the concept of it is so cool and what they do with it in this movie. And then the visuals of it match how cool the idea is. I was blown away by it the first time I saw it. I remember we watched this together at your place for the first time, I think probably pretty close to 2012 when it came out. We both were just gobsmacked by those effects.
You're right. There's something beautiful about the effect, but terrible in the way it's employed. Is kind of like that signature grimdark, you know, something that's just amazingly conceptually cool, but also, oh, Jesus, I would hate to be stuck in that situation.
Yeah.
And everyone, like, you know, Wood Harris is great as kind of like the main gangster. I think Lena Headey is, I don't know, she seems to delight in playing these just terrible villainous characters. Like, she's certainly played some virtuous ones, Sarah Chronicle and the Queen, the Spartan Queen. But, and here, you know, she's an extremely beautiful woman. I don't think that's controversial to say, but she really, really roughs herself up. You know, her face is scarred. She's got stage 10 meth mouth, greasy hair. There's an ugliness that's to the bone too. Like this, but even then there's also in that kind of like trademark way that Judge Dredd and hopefully the Warhammer series does, it's got, you can kind of see, it's like, man, can you really, she was pushed into this form by the mega city around her, you know? There's something that an evil judge says that is nevertheless true, that this is just a meat grinder. People go in one end, meat comes out the other, all we do is turn the handle.
I love that line.
Which is a great, this movie is full of them.
Yeah, that's the other thing about it. This movie has great dialogue.
And just how efficient. This is like a 90-minute capsule that it's very much you talk about this movie being a sign of the 2010s. Like, I think that the 2010s is going to be looked back on as like this action renaissance. You've got Dredd, you've got John Wick, you've got Fury Road that says we can have these pared down archetypal protagonists that all this insanity swirls around and grounds, and we just go for broke on the, and it's we don't need anything more complicated than we're trying to get to point A to point B. A man got a drug killed. Bust. He's going for revenge. two cops gets caught up in a drug bust. That's essentially, and you go back to the raid where it's, you know, this is a police raid gone bad, you know, with some interesting family dynamics and stuff like that. And so to say this movie is one of those highly influential action films that have kind of why we can enjoy things like Chris Hemsworth and Extraction. Is because Carl Urban refused to take off his helmet in Dredd, you know?
And, you know, Dredd is not necessarily a superhero. I mean, he's not superhuman. He has some maybe superhuman type armor and weapons and stuff. But this shows that you don't have to have a 2.5-hour superhero movie in order to make it interesting and effective.
You don't need an origin story. You don't need a movie to set up the premise so you can sell it. You just throw people into something. And that's why I think that's, you know, like my first experience with Judge Dredd is I was in like when I went to my first comic book store ever. You know, like, I'd only been to the drugstore in a small town. So it's just Spider-Man and X-Men and Superman and Batman. You go to a comic
on the spinning
store,
rack there. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Fucking exactly. That black wire spinning rack with the yep. Marvel DC symbol at the top. You didn't get any Image comics. You didn't get any Dark Horse comics. You didn't get those things on the top shelf where, like, full bodies are splattered and you might see some tits. Judge Dredd, it's like, yeah, it's like you pick up a Judge Dredd and that's how the comic treats. It's you're just in the middle of the story and he's doing some kind of cool, usually self-contained thing. And I think this movie, it kind of shows that, yeah, you don't need Tolkien-esque backstory and lore. You don't need, it's just, sure. You know, it's there if you want it. Like, Judge Dredd's been published for 40 fucking years. There's tons and tons and tons of lore, and I'm certainly not a Dredd historian, but yeah, he's kind of very bat. He's like the extreme form of Batman, post-apocalyptic Batman. He is a normal man, except for more so. He's just indomitable.
Yeah, it's if somehow you took a vigilante and gave them a badge, I mean, that's Dredd, right? Like, he's uh-huh. Judge, jury, executioner. I am the law. That thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, which Batman is that, but he doesn't have the law on his side and he's unwilling to kill, right. Whereas Judge Dredd kills. I mean, the sentence for almost everything is death.
And the thing is like, he also is very scrupulous about applying the law. Like, there's yep. many, this is kind of like, you know, in Asimov robot books, it's all about the three rules and how they work together and how they drive robots crazy. A lot of Judge Dredd is like, you think, because he's, you know, the putative hero, that he's going to have a sob story and uh-huh. he's going to, like, maybe turn his back or turn. He never fucking will. No, uh-uh. Yeah. No. Like, that orphan that helped him and saved him and he's going to still get 10 years in the ISO cube, you know,
mm-hmm.
At the end of the story, because that's the fucking law and that's who Judge Dredd is. So,
which maybe we should talk about, get into the actual plot of this thing, so that we can talk about spoilers, because there's an interesting twist around that in this movie.
I want to talk a little bit more about, you talk about the way this movie looks and the effects, like, even when it's mm-hmm. not being special effects, this movie cost around $40 million to make. And the setting allows them to get away with some really cheap things. Like, this, legendarily, this set was essentially a couple of sections, a concrete hallway, a concrete staircase, a couple concrete columns, and an elevator. Mm-hmm. And they made, and a couple outside shots of some brutalist architecture in South Africa, and they made mm-hmm. a whole movie on that. Like, the minigun scene, which was one of the most visually impressive scenes, they use heavy fog and, like, yellow lights to hide the fact that there is nothing beyond the wall that Mama is shooting out. Like, uh-huh. It's just a blank, empty set, but it looks so fucking cool. And when Dredd comes out of that thing with a dude he's going to throw off, that's just a couple prefab concrete walls, a fog machine, and some LED lights, man. Yeah.
And I mean, even the effects done on the slow-mo stuff, they're not expensive effects. There's not a lot of...
It's something,
like,
you could pull
CG
off of
work being done. It's a lot of stuff you could almost get in camera, but it's definitely post production.
You could do that in Adobe Audition back in 2012. It might take you some time and a couple layering and do some rendering, but yeah, it's just very creative, lo-fi filmmaking that looks like a million bucks.
A lot of practical effects too. They used a lot of compressed air to get some of the effects of, like, rippling mm-hmm. skin and things like that. There are a lot of lo-fi creative ways to get what looks like a really hi-fi effect.
Yeah, and I also really think the music fits it too. It's not, I guess, Paul Leonard Morgan did the soundtrack on this, but it's a lot of just this kind of, like, digital, that kind of is like a ticking time, because, you know, the judges are just on being caught the whole time. And then there's also this kind of, like, haunting lunar techno stuff that happens at dramatic moments, which is good, which is amazing. But I think it perfectly suits the bleak, kind of stark filmmaking it's complimenting.
Yeah, I think the composer said he was going for something timeless, which I don't think they achieved here. I mean, anytime you're using electronic music, it doesn't sound timeless. If you're going for an orchestral score or something, that sounds a lot more timeless to me. There was one thing I learned, though, that shocked and surprised me because I had no idea that this person made music. Do you know that there's a Matt Berry song in this movie?
No.
Yeah.
No, I did not.
It's wild, but when you first see Domhnall Gleeson, I forget what his character's name is in this.
I know, just for the audience, I don't know that Matt Berry is quite the household name, but Matt Berry is the best vampire on What We Do in the Shadows. He was also the Toast of London. I can't remember. Like, I know he's been in some bigger, higher profile. And I think he's going to explode any minute now. Cause,
yeah, he's in The Mighty Boosh. If you've seen that, a lot of British shows. Obviously, he's British. A lot of his
wasn't
career
he the boss? You just mentioned he was the boss in
IT Crowd. Yeah,
and the IT Crowd in
the second
two going forward.
Series of that.
Yeah.
But apparently, one of his songs is in here. He did a show called Snuffbox. And the theme from Snuffbox is in here, and he sings and I guess wrote that theme. He has 9 studio albums that he has put out. I had no idea the man sang.
Are they like novelty albums, or is this like Brent Spiner?
I don't think so.
He's actually trying to do serious work.
I listened to some of it. I will say I don't care for it. It's not my cup of tea.
Because I think it's got to be British lounge singer. That's got to be what the aesthetic is, right?
It's not lounge music. It's like soft rock, I would say. It's
all right. I want to.
Yeah, it's not great in my opinion. But you know, 9 studio albums, and I had no idea. So one of his songs is in here. It's when you first see Domhnall Gleeson.
Interesting. Okay. But all right, so you want to talk more about the plot. I think we've talked our way through the look and the feel. Again, highly recommend. Like, this is reliably a hit with people that don't even like action films. I think there's a well-written, well-developed lady character that is not embroiled in any kind of romance with Judge Dredd, because Judge Dredd doesn't do that type of shit. And it's just, yeah, and if you hate it, it's only 90 minutes, you know? Shut it off at 60. I don't give a fuck, but I think everyone should try it because it's good. This movie, I'm gonna give you the brief synopsis. This movie is about the near future, after an atomic war and various other things. I think a plague. There's a bunch of shit that happened to Earth. The United States is shattered into essentially 5 big mega cities. Like the entire eastern seaboard is one giant mega city, LA and Seattle and all that. There's this is about Mega City 1. And Judge Dredd is the most fierce judge of the whole city. There's 12 major crimes a second, 17,000 a day. Judges can only respond to 6% of them. And they are empowered by the justice system to investigate, prosecute, and execute criminals in true street justice. Dredd is asked to give the qualification exam for a rookie who should be a washout. She's a couple percent shy of the judge ideal, but she's a psyker. She has psychic powers, so the justice system is invested in getting her to pass. But they're still giving her to Judge Dredd, and they get assigned to investigate 3 homicides in this giant block-sized apartment building called Peach Trees, and chaos ensues. Will Judge Dredd make it out alive? Will Rookie Anderson pass qualifications as a judge? The answers probably will not surprise you, but you'll be entertained as you get your suspicions confirmed along the way. And there is some kind of like twists and turns in the margins too. All right, where do you want to start, Jim? We'll be right back with more Bald Move after this brief pause. Here's what's new in premium content for our club members.
This Tuesday, we're back off the clock with a new premium podcast covering our experiences with the new Amazon series Fallout, Alex Garland's Civil War, as well as some thoughts on X-Men 97.
Then on Friday, The Old Reliable, Lunch with Jim and Aaron. Join us in the Munch Crowd to watch us record live at 1 p.m. Eastern, or check out the podcast later that day.
If you want more Bald Move in your life, head over to support.baldmove.com to find out how you can get tons of bonus audio and video content, plus ad-free feeds.
We try to make it super easy to support making podcasts at Bald Move. Just join the club.
But some people aren't the joining type, or maybe they're already in the club but want to add a little bit of gratuity for an especially great season of coverage, or for a podcast that really spoke to them, or gave them that bit of support in a tough time.
For these, and for whatever other reason you might have, our tip jar is always open. Head over to support.baldmove.com and click the donate option to say, hey, keep doing what you're doing. We appreciate it.
Once again, check out support.baldmove.com for all the great ways to help me and Jim keep making the podcast you love.
And now, back with more Bald Move.
This is spoilers from here on out.
Yes. I want to talk about the concept of the film, because you mentioned, you know, Raid Redemption, and I guess Raid Redemption 2. They're both kind of this concept, but the concept of, well, and the one that I saw before this, that we both saw before this, is The Protector. The Protector has this concept as well, where essentially the bad guy is at the top of a tower, and you have to climb that tower, run the gauntlet of floors until you get to the top of that tower to have your final showdown. It's like a video game. I think it's maybe the best concept for an action movie I've ever seen.
Yeah.
It just feels like you're progressing through ever more difficult challenges as you go floor by floor. Makes so much sense.
Yeah. Yeah, it's such a spare structure. You know, you got this judge. He's got a rookie, and you mentioned the level, like, because like in Mortal Kombat, you know, you kind of like as you fight up, you go up the
tower. Yeah, literally. Yeah,
going back to the days of Mario and Donkey Kong, you're just climbing to the top of a tower to defeat a boss villain. You know, this is the Castlevania. They all have a lot of that similar structure, and it's so easy to follow. Like, I kept on making note of every 15 minutes Judge Dredd will get a new micro objective, like, shit, the blast doors have closed and the transmission's out, we gotta head to the med center, you know. So the next 15 minutes in the med center, he's stymied, and then Mama does a transmission and he's gotta go investigate that. And it's just like, at no point do you ever wonder what the fuck is going on and why are we doing this? Everything feels really grounded, even though every part of the building looks like every other part of the building. You never kind of like wonder what floor is he on, this, that, and the other. Which I think is amazing. I think it's amazing. And I also wondered, because like there's a couple shots where, like, after Mama gives her announcement, which is also another great way to cut budget. You don't want to pay hundreds of extras, so have your mega crime boss just say, everybody get indoors and don't come out for the duration of the movie.
Yeah.
So now it's just
75,000 people in this building, right? But they're all shut in.
Yeah. There's just going to be nothing but bare concrete walls and like six stuntmen. That's the most you ever have to film. But
it's what they should have done with Lord of the Rings, right? At Minas Tirith, just, you know, everybody, okay, hide under these tarps and pop out when you're fighting. That's it.
That would have been cheaper than writing a whole software system from scratch to do armies of 1,000. But they really get away with some really sparse storytelling that way. And just extremely efficient. You know, it's almost, we talked about this with Spielberg, the way he wrote Indiana Jones, which looks baroque compared to this movie. But like, that movie is every 10 minutes someone running up to Indiana Jones is like, oh my god, it's now over here. And Indiana Jones goes, where? In that plane. Psh, psh, psh. Now it's on that truck. Where are the and it's just now it's on the sub, and it's just one goddamn thing after another, as Roger Ebert famously described it. And this is that.
No, it works.
This is that. A stripped down, almost like an untextured video game. Just 3D polygonal frame video game is what this movie is.
And they do a great job with the escalation of the scenarios, right? At first, you kind of get, he's just fighting regular dudes with guns, like in hallways and stuff. And eventually he's fighting, you know, the personal guard of Mama. And then they get to the point where he's fighting other judges, which I think is a brilliant concept. because, you know, he's tough, but what about against four judges? And then in the end, they have, you know, the final challenge, which is how do you defeat somebody who has a kill switch attached to them? And I think the answer is brilliant.
Especially since I don't think Judge Dredd cared either way.
Yeah, yeah. It seemed like he needs to execute this person because that's the law, and
yeah,
he
it's
goes
like,
down
well,
with him.
I'm either going to tear this rod out by out of the top of the tree or by the root. Either way, it's going to be done.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, you're right. But that escalation of the challenges he's facing as they go through this tower, I think is really smoothly done.
Yeah. We talked about kind of around the whole slow-mo effect, but I think
yes.
That's like the perfect. This is what you're always looking for. This grim dark that I'm that this really appeals to me in the Games Workshop stuff. And this is like 2080 comics is the actual comic that Judge Dredd appears in, I think.
Okay.
Is that it's like you've got this where you first introduced the slow-mo. It's the gangbangers in their car, they're fleeing whatever the crime, and it just looks like this like a candy flip plus salvia,
sure,
plus all this time dilation, and everything is just looks like it's coated in prisms and rainbows, and it's beautiful. There's also that scene where Lena is in the bathtub and she's like, you know, splashing the water around. You see all that, it's so cool. But then it's used in the context of we're going to skin men alive.
Yep.
And then throw them off a 200-story balcony. And we're going to give them a hit of slow-mo just before so it seems like it lasts a year.
Yeah. Yeah.
And also... Go ahead.
No, go ahead. I want to talk a lot about slow-mo.
I also love how you're in that beautiful slow-mo effect from the POV of these guys with the skinned flesh. And you're kind of like caught up in like the, you know, like, Jesus, this is so fucked up, but it's also awesome and it sounds great. And then the movie smash cuts to the plaza where suddenly there's no sound, there's no rainbows, there's no prisms, and it's just a blood bag hitting cement at about 200 miles an hour. Slap. Ugh. And then everyone's
right next
reaction.
To children and
Yeah. Doesn't it kill a dude? I think it like literally obliterates something. It like falls on
maybe.
Top of somebody, I think.
Yeah, I didn't see that. But it's apparently it slows time down to about 1% of its actual speed. Your perception of time down to 1% of its actual speed, which I think has to like really overdrive your brain, right? I mean, this stuff must just fry you. Because it's like overclocking a processor. If you wanted to do make a task seem like it takes 1% of the time, you would have to overclock the crap out of it, and it would probably burn the processor up. It probably does the same to your brain.
Yeah.
These people don't seem incredibly adversely affected by it. It's not like one hit and you're kind of out of it. It seems like you could do it all the time. And it
every drug, you know, like heroin, meth, crocodile.
Mm-hmm.
The first hit doesn't do too much to you. It's the cumulative effect of that stuff.
For sure. And that's a great plot contrivance, too. I think, like, I don't know if you can use it as a cool thing in the plot and also make it look really cool. It's kind of the best of both worlds. And man, the scene that stands out to me for that is the scene where they bust into the den where everybody's doing slow-mo and they just start lighting the room up with bullets and they start... The bullets go through their guts and their faces and their arms, and it's all at 1% speed. So you're seeing the flesh rippling from the explosive force of the door blowing in as they come inside, and then the gunshots causing essentially waves of flesh as they hit, and rivulets of blood just beautifully flying through the air with rainbow effects. It's stunning to look at, even though it is gruesome.
Like the one guy gets shot in the jaw and you can see like teeth exploding out one side of his face.
Yeah. Ugh.
Yeah. Yeah. I really like the way the shockwaves hit, like, you know, the dude's gut and how the impacts. It's
apparently
it's
they
really
use compressed
cool.
air to get that effect
I wondered if it was digital because I looked at it and I'm like, man, this looks like it's really real. I wonder how they did that with the cheap, and yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
Some of it has to be digital.
A lot of giggles on set that day, I bet.
I bet, yeah. Take a look at that in slow-mo.
I guess let me see your Pillsbury Doughboy belly. Okay. Uh-huh. It's like me, you know. Is just hitting him with the air wand, you know?
I think in slow-mo with that driving scene, it would probably make you a way better driver.
Yeah.
Right?
Although, would the impatience of being stuck in that system make you drive, like, you are much carefuler, but you want to drive 200 miles an hour because it feels like you're just not going anywhere, so.
Yeah, yeah. You have a concept of, like, how fast you can take a corner at regular speed, but if you're going 200 miles an hour and it only feels like 4 miles an hour, you might just roll right off a corner.
Yeah. How long do you think slow-mo lasts?
That is a really good question.
That's where I threw in salvia into my drug cocktail, because like it feels like one of those things where you go on a whole ass trip. Mm-hmm. And you come out sweating and say, how long was I done? Your buddy's like, 30 seconds, dude. What the fuck? It's like,
it felt like 3 hours. It has to be at least like a minute. I mean, how long did it take you to fall from 200 stories? That's the minimum time.
Yeah, I think the what I judged was like you could see these guys taking hits of slow-mo in the getaway car. And like somewhere between then and halfway through the chase, they all are sobered up.
Yeah, true.
So like, I feel like it is got to be like a 30 to 60. Certainly long enough to get your ass thrown off of a 100 floor building and experience the entire way down. But because it'd also be like, if it was longer than that, it'd be like crippling. Imagine if you took a hit of slow-mo and it's like an hour or two.
And you get a phone call in the middle of it. Like, you just can't have a conversation.
You have to take a shit or something. Like, oh.
Just trying to make it to the bathroom.
No. You're trying to get off the couch like that, you know? Like anything, it'd just be, it's just like, you know, you get an extra strong hit and it's like you hit limbo in Inception. Oh my God, I'm down here for 75 years. I'm going to become an old man.
You come back and the commercials aren't even over. Yeah.
Oh man.
No, I think, man, there's a whole lot of fun sort of shorts you could make around people taking slow-mo at different times.
Oh yeah, that'd be really, you could do some fun work with that. What do you make of, we talked about just kind of like the cleverness of the filmmaking in terms of informing the kind of brutalist, sparse look, but what did you think of the way they adapted the Judge Dredd of it all? His uniform, his weapons, his motorcycles.
I don't know anything about that. I've seen the original movie.
Okay, because
I've never read any comics.
That's a pretty accurate, like, that's just stepped off the page. That's really? Like if you put
Except
Hugh Jackman
Stallone.
In. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Stallone. But even then, Stallone, he does take the helmet off. And that was huge. That was super fucking. That was a scandal in the day. But when he's got the helmet on, he looks like Judge Dredd. And his motorcycle looks exactly like the lawmaker, and his gun looks exactly like the lawgiver. It's very, very accurate. And I think because of that, a little silly.
Okay. I mean, here's the thing. I'm judging it against that 1985 movie or whenever it was. Yeah. And I think if I'm going to say that Stallone was a great pick for Judge Dredd, I think Carl Urban is perfect for it as well. I know he's a little like slimmer. He's not kind of a tank. And I don't know if Judge Dredd is supposed to be a tank. He's definitely like slimmer than Stallone, but he's not.
Yeah.
But he's also taller. So there's kind of an imposing physicality to him that way.
It's hard to say because Judge Dredd in the comics has kind of like these unreal proportions. Like sometimes he looks like really angular, depending on the artist that's drawing him, et cetera. Sometimes he looks like he's wide and stout. Sometimes he looks like he's like more skinny and lanky. He's also got these huge shoulder pads and helmets and boots
with the
and...
eagle. I know they took that off of there. I want to say it was like for mobility's sake or something. But it also looked really freaking stupid
it did
in the original movie.
And they say they took it off. They didn't. They just made it more of a slimline molded, you know, kind of thing rather than this giant pauldron.
I do love the badges on the costumes. I think those badges are so cool.
I did
like
wonder,
the eagle, and then you got the name kind of slashing through it.
I did wonder, like, you get a name much longer than Anderson, and it's going to look like it's a barcode. You know, like if you get too many people from the wrong nationality, or God help you,
or something.
Greek name's going to be rough. Some Indian name's going to be rough. Hyphenated names. If your mom's a feminist in the 2000, God help you, because no one's going to be able to read your badge. No one's going to take you seriously as a judge.
Yeah, you're right. I wonder if they could do two lines with a hyphenated.
That's probably what they do. They just go two lines. You even go three. Mm-hmm. It looks like it's going to look like the Ten Commandments if they keep going. Mm-hmm. But I did the, because like I, as much as I like the look and feel of the Sly Stallone film, I gotta say that film is like, I've said this before, one of the reasons I think the first truly successful comic book film outside of like, you know, Superman and DC and Batman, which are all these mythic kind of archetypal characters, you can kind of get away with that literal look, is X-Men, because they have Hugh Jackman walking around in like yellow and blue spandex, you know, with little horned cowl coming off. That looks so fucking dope in the comic books, but it just looks like ridiculous. The same way as, you know, Robin's outfit, you know, he's got this bright red vest and a yellow cape, and he's got these green underwear and the little elf boots like that. You can't do that in a comic book movie.
I mean, now we've come full circle and you've got characters like MODOK. So,
well, see, that's why I was saying is that I was about to bring it around to like nowadays people respect the form so much that you can have like a classic 1960s Loki and green and yellow spandex, you know, and you can have like, I think The Watchmen did this really well too, where they started a movie very grim, realistic aesthetic, but it wasn't too long before you got into the flashback era where they were just like dressed as like golden age comic book guys. You know, they had the underwear on the outside of their pants, and it's like it would be easier to transition from Dredd to Judge Dredd than Judge Dredd, because it's just too much.
Yeah, I agree. The stuff in Judge Dredd looks pretty silly. This looks a little more grounded, and I hear it was a little more grounded too in its construction. Like, the motorcycle that Stallone was driving apparently couldn't even really function as a motorcycle because the wheels were too big.
Right.
This one, they scaled down the wheels just enough to where the bike could still drive. So they're
real
considering
motorcycle.
Some reality there.
It's a real motorcycle. Carl Urban insisted on driving it, and then instead of using a stuntman. So Carl Urban's really driving his motorcycle. And there is, like, because this movie is the vast majority of it practical, it looks great. It looks really real. It's got this very gritty, grounded look to it. And it goes down to, like, the acting. Like, the way Judge Dredd goes down a corridor. It's very tactical, but he doesn't crouch. He doesn't take cover. He goes down the middle of the hallway, standing tall and proud. You know, like there is some kind of grandiosity about it.
And he's maybe used a gas grenade to keep people from shooting him, or he's used some other method. Like it also never felt like he was just a sitting duck, and he didn't get killed because the movie didn't want him to get killed. It felt like he didn't have to run for cover because all of his weapons and his armor were doing their jobs.
As experience, because I'd say he's not standing tall and proud to be like foolish. It's because it communicates that he is utterly in control of the situation and the battlefield.
And I think it's interesting that changes when he's against other judges too, right? He does take cover. He does sneak around. He is a lot more cautious around them.
Right, because they're a threat over these kind of peach tree punks. That's a good point. I really like the Batman-esque, you know, I don't know how accurate this is to the comics, but, like, it must be, because this was something they even did in this Stallone, that, like, the gun itself is, like, Batman's utility belt. And then they literally have a utility belt. They can pull out, like, get these, like, real... I thought these rebreather designs are awesome. It's like a scuba thing you put in your mouth, but also has a hood that covers your nose. Mm-hmm. So it looks really high-tech and futuristic, but Yeah, he's got the gas grenade. That incendiary round was pretty.
Oh man!
Just enjoy your shower of white phosphorus, boys. That was horrifying.
I liked how responsive the gun is to the voice commands. Like he can say "hot shot" as he's firing, and it will fire that round. He doesn't have to turn it to him, speak into the mic, and then turn it back to the bad guy.
And he can chain things together, like he goes like rapid fire, incendiary, high explosive, and it's just like a super shot. The gun can like it's like a cocktail. It's just they're mixing rounds and stuff.
I suppose so, yeah.
Oh, when he hit that one dude in the head with the incendiary round and it just briefly turned him into a living jack-o'-lantern, I've seen that effect before. There's at least one zombie movie where somebody did a flare in a zombie's mouth, but I haven't seen that too many times, and this might be my favorite interpretation of that effect. Just lighting some insanely hot thing off in someone's skull.
Yeah. Not since Ghost Rider has there been a skull flame that good.
Yeah.
I will say, though, I don't know that he needed to hotshot that guy. Does Judge Dredd just hate criminals that much? He doesn't have to hotshot. A regular round would have taken that guy down just as fast.
Yeah, I felt like he was stunting a little bit. Because I
a
thought that,
bit.
Too. Because it had been a while since I've seen this movie. And when he's doing that, I was like, oh, is he going to do the RoboCop thing where he's just such a good shot? Or is he going to use like some kind of like boomerang round that, you know, the guy is going to do the, ha-ha, you missed me, Judge, and it comes and kills him from behind or something. But I forgot that he is, because the thing is like, I think that dude could have still shot that woman in the head. Like, he probably had a second of consciousness where he realized his head was cooking. And
yeah, not what I would choose to do with my last 2 seconds of life, but I don't know what else you do with it.
Because let's talk about that. I think that you can make an argument that Judge Dredd would be okay with that outcome if that lady died, because he didn't kill her. The perp did. And how do you think Judge Dredd sees civilian casualties?
I don't think he'll necessarily go too far out of his way to prevent them. But it's interesting because like Kay, when they grab him, she's 99% sure that he's committed a crime, that he's the murderer of these three people. But 99% is not good enough for a conviction in this case. They need to be 100%. So instead of killing him and getting rid of this baggage that haunts them the entire movie, they tote him around through this incredibly dangerous battlefield. So to me, that says like he will go to great lengths to execute the law, But yeah, if there's something that happens outside of his purview, maybe not. But it's so easy to become a criminal in his eyes, too, and get a death sentence.
Sure.
Yeah.
This is something that I was kind of a theory I was cooking up, that like Judge Dredd knew from almost a jump there was some bigger thing there. And that was why it's not that he's against assassinating this guy, but it's more of like, if you're not, you're 1% not sure what's going on, then that's a thread that he can pull at. And eventually he investigates all the way to the top with Mama, shuts down the slow-mo operation, drug bust, perps resisted, just another day for Judge Dredd. But I wondered how much of that, because I thought but also Judge Dredd is like, within the bounds of the law, he is very scrupulous. Like, I can't execute a guy just because he's annoying or because it'd be expedient.
Yeah. I want to talk about the when they break into the lady's house, which I think is actually, look, there aren't very many weak points in this movie. I think it's maybe the biggest mistake I see in this movie. And we can talk about it in a second. But the way he treats her is just like, tie her up, stick her in another room, and we'll continue our mission. So he's okay get like sidelining civilians in kind of violent and aggressive ways, but I don't think he would have killed her. I don't think it's a matter of like, oh, if people are coming in we got to really shut her up. And if she screams, I don't know if she starts screaming if he kills her. Is that a kind of illegal thing to do?
Yeah, I think so. And
she's saying the judges are here, come get him. Yeah, that's aiding and abetting, you know, the murder of a judge. Yeah. But like, if she just starts screaming because people enter her house.
Yeah. And I think like Judge Dredd is like calloused at death, but I don't think he's like indifferent to it. Like I talk about like, you know, that in the comics, like a lot of the dark humor is that, you know, you'll be like, surely Judge Dredd's going to give him this dude a break because he's a mutant, or he had a hard life for this, or he actually helped him at the beginning of the mission. And then he never does because they committed a crime and they got to do the time. But like, I do think I've seen a couple where he's got a soft spot towards children, especially. Like, okay. You know, he does believe in the fact that there are innocents that are to be protected. And I think, what did you think of his, my statement of him having kind of a character arc? Because, you know, it's like you look at how he sees the and there may be another hint about how he views the guy that they run over in the, you know, it's like it definitely seems that angers him. Mm-hmm. You know, more than this is just the accelerant to the crime. And then when he's asking Anderson, like, why did you join the judges? And she gives this statement about, like, you know, I grew up in places like this. You know, there's a lot of good people here, and I want to serve and protect and help them. And he kind of, like, he says admirable. But he also kind of with his body language, like, yeah, give it a couple of years and see if you still feel that way.
Yeah, totally.
But by the end of the movie, like, there's a couple things where she does where, you know, she lets a guy go because he's not a perp, he's a victim. The fact that, you know, she didn't take the expedient way out, which would be to kill Wood Harris and proceed alone. That I felt like that he is a little bit. Has a little bit of his, I don't know, sense of justice or sense of like you that they can make a difference restored by the end of the movie.
Yeah, I think so. I think that's his arc, right? He does not want anything to do with Anderson at the beginning of this movie because she's a fail. She's 3-point shy,
it's a washout
of
yeah.
passing her exam, her judge exam. And, you know, his higher ups are bending the rules and forcing him to go out with her to evaluate her again. And by the end of the movie, he's waiving that 3 points, right? She failed. By the strict definition of the rules, she lost her primary weapon. That's an automatic fail. And yet he says she's a pass. So, yeah, he has softened certainly on at least her in particular. And I think that's, yeah, where he comes down.
And it's like, I think he sees her as exceptional. I think he saw this as much as he says to the chief judge that it was just a drug bust. Like, I think he knows this was a fucking hairball to throw a rookie into, too.
Oh,
he's
yeah.
not even wearing a helmet, which he's also skeptical about. Yeah.
And I love that they have her pick the mission at random, you know, just like, oh, let's respond to this triple homicide over at Sector 13 over at Peachtree's.
Well, I haven't seen this movie so many times. I got so many theories. I actually think that was part of the test that Judge Dredd did. The whole reason that he's bending the rules and doing this rookie is because the Chief Justice said, we really think this girl's psychic abilities are going to make a difference to the Justice Department. So he says the whole movie, he's like, okay, we'll fucking see. She picks at random which crime to investigate. She picks these 3 homicides. I think that's kind of a test. Like, that ended up being this huge bust of this infamous character who was flooding Mega City with drugs. Like,
so her he's testing her psychic ability there?
Yeah,
like,
there's a little bit of Minority
something?
Report. And he's like seeing like, okay, let's see if there's anything to this Ouija board shit. And then he's impressed that she's able to use her psychic abilities to get a civilian to open a door to him. And he's impressed that she's able to interrogate this guy. Not in the non-violent, because Judge Dredd doesn't care if you get the confession beating a guy's teeth out or going into his mind
and
biting his mentally biting his dick off, but like he's impressed with the efficiency of it, right? And it's like, I think that by the end of the movie he's convinced by the support, like, that yes, this would be awesome, we would be better at our jobs if we had more Andersons, so yeah, it's worth giving a psyker like this a slide.
Yeah, that makes sense. I do wonder what exactly her abilities are. Clearly, she's able to read minds. I think that, and she's able to enter minds and have the person also realize that she's in there and screw with their head, right? It's not just, oh, I can read your thoughts. Mm-hmm. It's, I can make your thoughts. I can interact with your thoughts. And man, they do that to great effect in that scene that you were talking about with the biting the dick off. Cause it's actually Mama who does it, which I love. Right. Like, and he's got such swagger at the beginning. He's like, oh, now you're locked in here with me because it's my head. I can make you do whatever I want. And my brain is so much more fucked up than yours is.
And she lets
he doesn't realize is she grew up in that shit, too. Like,
right.
She on a worse couple of days, she is him.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And yeah, he just steps into an arena he did not think he could lose in. And man, he does.
Yeah, because he put her back on her back heels in the scene before. So, like, I remember the first time I saw this movie when he mentally disrobed her and, like, pushed her him down to his penis. Be very clinical. I was like, oh, uh-huh. God, they're going to Troy her. They're going to let him mentally rape the... And then, like, no, 5 seconds later, she's got Mama biting his dick off. And
yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I thought it was pretty well done.
It's extremely well done. Although I have to say, it does then have me questioning why she doesn't use this more often, because there's a scene later where he is also standing in front of her with a gun about to shoot her. She could just mentally bite his dick off again.
I have that in my notes. Why did she not psychically bite his dick again?
Yep.
Because it's like, but so there must be some kind of like mental effort or like preparation, you know? Like she had to like.
I mean,
do
she
some
did
kinda...
also have the backup of she knew he couldn't kill her with that gun, right? Because that's the
True.
Gun that when he tries to use it, ID failed and it blows his arm off.
So she's kind of like, yeah, kind of luring him into a false sense of confidence, because she also knows at that point in that room he can't rape her, he can't beat her, because Mama said you can't do that. We got to make it look like an accident, and you can't go sexual sadist on her. So she knows all she's got to do is keep talking until he gets the gun and tries to shoot her, and then she's got her opening. So that makes, why would she?
Yeah, I guess that does that neatly solves that problem.
And also, I don't think you can do it in the heat of combat. Like, I don't think maybe because I think this Anderson character is a recurring character that gets stronger throughout the series. I think I've done a deep lore dive and I remember that. You know, that's the thing about psychic powers, like they can do anything, right? But this is kind of like her just starting to get her powers and abilities, and feels like, she just has like some modicum of like preparation and meditation and mental clarity to pull these moves off. It's not like she can wade out into the field of battle and just have guys turn their guns on like she's not Charles Xavier, at least not yet.
Sure. And also they make it a point that her helmet interferes or can interfere, is what she says, with her psychic abilities, which I'm not sure if this is a mistake or the can interfere of it all kind of plasters over this, but she reads dread through his helmet at the beginning of this movie.
That is an inconsistency.
Maybe it's a proximity of the metal of the helmet to her head. Maybe it's a sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't when there's a helmet involved.
Yeah.
I don't know. But a little bit, of a head scratcher there. Can I talk about the one problem I have?
Okay, because I have one too. We can do a 1-2 punch, unless it's the same problem.
Okay. I think it's a mistake. It's not a problem because it works, but it would have worked better, I think, to have... the scene where they bust into the woman's apartment and she sees the picture and she realizes that she's killed that guy, her husband, who's like the father of her child or whatever. She realizes she's already killed him. I think it would have worked better to flip those scenes. Don't have her kill him first. Have her have to kill him later. And I don't know if she was like reading his mind when she was trying to kill him, because she hesitates on that guy, right? That's the one where a judge is like... He broke the law. You know what you have to do. The sentence is death. Sentence, Get on with it, rookie. But she hesitates. So Was she reading his mind there and seeing that he had a child and that she didn't want to kill the father of a child?
I think so. That, like, she saw the web of connections this guy had, and he did commit. Yeah. And
I feel like it would have worked better the other way, where you meet the woman and she says, my husband is out there. I just want him to come back. You know, I don't want to tell you guys. I just want you off my floor, because if you're off my floor, my husband won't get killed. And then she has to put a bullet in him later.
Oh, I don't think that was literally her husband, though.
It is, yeah. They do the flashback and everything. It's the they show the photo of him. Yeah.
Okay. Because I was thinking that maybe that was why it gave her pause when she's talking to the lady. It's like because she saw, like, she already murdered one husband and one father, and she's trying to avoid, you know, because she's also sensitive to that in a way that Judge Dredd can't be.
Yeah.
You know, there's a couple other, I didn't quite finish my thesis on Judge Dredd's morality. There's a couple other indications we have of his interior state. And one is, the way he treated those juveniles that got the drop on him. Is like, you know, you can do body bags or juvie cubes, which one you want to do.
Juve cubes. I love that.
And they
term.
Try to kill him, and he still, even though he could kill them, he stuns them instead.
Yeah,
like he is a little bit of a softy again for these kids that might have a way to turn their lives around. I mean, he might still throw their ass in a juve cube, but he didn't kill him. And the other is, like,
do we know that isn't the law? Like, don't kill kids.
I don't. Well, I mean, they assaulted a judge. Like, that's.
Well, but is there an exception for kids to do that? You know,
I don't.
Do they go
think
to juve
so.
Cubes instead of penalty of death?
I mean, here again, I'm not a Judge Dredd historian. I've read like three.
I've
read three issues and two movies, but and the other one is that he is genuinely offended by the corrupt judges. Like, you get the idea that this is like shocking and disgusting to him. The way this guy talks about, like using this to his benefit, and that like these are just meat, and that we, like, he rejects that cynicism of, you know, we're just turning the handle. He doesn't see it that way.
Yeah, no, for sure.
I did like that, like, they're those young punks, like, trying to buck themselves up to kill Dredd. They're like talking themselves into it, say like, oh, why do we have to be the one to find him? And
yeah,
but they're also really scared of Mama. And
yeah, the other kids that you meet out there on the skate ramp. I just wonder, like, when he blew the wall open, how many kids flew off that vert ramp to their deaths 200 stories below or whatever.
You know, I had a memory that, like, Anderson said something like, how did you know that there's a skate park underneath where we jumped out? And he said, I didn't. But that didn't happen. Like, that was my clear implication that Judge Dredd saw daylight. And he's like, oh, exterior wall. And he's like, well, you know, better to jump out and die than to certainly get chewed up by this minigun. But I don't think he knew. It's just kind of like, oh, okay, yeah, well, I didn't die this time.
Yeah. No, that makes sense.
How high a trick would you hit on that half pipe?
Zero high.
That looked terrifying, right?
Yeah.
Is that a little bit of the grim dark that there's just children playing on this vertical death machine 50 stories high? Like,
yeah,
unsupervised.
I mean, look, if you're a good skateboarder, that's got to be badass, right?
Oh,
go
yeah.
Go up for your trick and you're just hanging out there
can
over nothing.
Just looking out and you can see the whole city. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I really like how they did the three judges. Because when I first saw this movie, when the three judges come in and they take it over, like, I guess I didn't realize they were bad. And I liked how that they used the medical guy who had previously been neutral. He's just interested in saving his own life, but has been so impressed by Dredd's grit and resolve and, you know, determination that he's now going to go and violate his neutrality to help these judges out and gets him killed instantly. And
yeah. Are you prepared to testify to that?
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. Pow, done. You're dead. And it's like, oh shit, we got some bent screws here.
Yes. I love that intro.
That's why I was saying, like, it's, you know, this movie's not surprising in how it ends, but it does have a few twists and turns along the way.
Yeah, and that's interesting. So I don't think it needs to be surprising in how it ends. I think it's kind of perfect in how it ends. It ends with a showcase that you've wanted all movie of slow-mo, right? Like, that's the showstopper here. And I think they knew it. And It's interesting to me because I know that they messed with effects for a while around slow-mo, both like during production and post-production. I wonder how much they knew, like, we have just a banger effect here and we want to center the movie around that versus like finding it after in post-production.
I don't know, because it does seem they were justifiably proud of it. I think they knew, like, this was even before this. Alex Garland had this kind of set piece in mind like 2 years before the movie was even, you know, like, what if there was this drug that slowed down perception of time and like kind of like, you know, what all you could do cool in like a sci-fi crime setting with that. And I think they knew they had a bank, because how could you not? How could you be sitting in the editing bay and watch, or, you know, get a demo of that and be like, fuck. I mean, everything about Lena Headey's death, the way, like, I even like, even though it's a little cheesy, I even like the from the floor's perspective, her face hitting it and kind of like turning and flattening, and you can't really see, but just blood everywhere.
It's happening, right? Like, I feel like I'm on slow-mo in that moment, because like, it's happening in slow motion. She's coming down, we get this POV from the ground, and her face is coming down, and it keeps coming down, and you're like, are they gonna go all the way with this? Like, in slow motion, I'm trying to judge whether I think they're gonna really go for it here, because really going for it means her face hits the concrete and we see it in all of its gory detail. And they absolutely go for it. They blew me away. I was expecting them to cut at any moment, you know, okay, she's coming down, cut to a side view where it'll be less gory. Nope.
Yeah, and a movie that's 90 minutes long, spending a whole minute on a character's death in slow motion could seem indulgent, but it's just so perfect of fate for her, who, you know, we've seen, like, she's poisoned the whole city with this drug. She's particularly cruel in its implementation, having it, you know, getting paid back in kind. And with the devil may care attitude that Dredd does it, too. Because he's like, she's like so confident, like, you know, I've got you. You can't kill me. It'll kill the whole building. You can't do that. And him just kind of looking down and be like, what do you think the range on that transmitter is?
100 stories of concrete? 200?
I will say, this is the dumbest implementation of a dead woman switch I've ever seen.
Oh, yeah. It has to send a signal, not lose the signal. Yeah,
Dredd would have been laughing out the other side of a scowl if it was sending a constant signal and she gets halfway down and the building explodes, because that's how you would program a dead woman switch like that, right?
Yeah, obviously.
Soon as I stop the heartbeat, you blow up. Not, oh, the heartbeat is done, send the signal and blow up. But it's a good thing. Good thing Domhnall Gleeson's a shitty programmer.
Yeah, I guess if I had to point out another minor flaw, it's that. But it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter because of how cool this scene is.
So I've got to my flaw. I want to talk about, because I just reminded to talk about Domhnall Gleeson. I really like his character, and I really like the relationship he has with Mama. I love, because like, I at first I thought, why the fuck would you be fucking with this guy who is trying to Han Solo your way out of getting arrested or killed, or like, why would you do that? And the last couple times I've watched, I've gotten the idea that she's doing that for a purpose. Like, she is getting, first of all, she's getting her best, his best performance, and also she's getting authentically stressed out. Like, if a guy's on the phone telling two judges to pound sand, I can't get my keyboard to work right, that should be terrifying. Mm-hmm. He should be afraid. He should be stressed out. If he's got his supervisor at Peachtree up his ass about this test he's fucked up, he should be kind of like on the bur-. And I think that she's trying to give him like an authentic performance with that. Is that okay, track for you?
That's pretty generous reading of that to me, because I read it differently.
Fuck?
No, I read it as, if I don't monitor this guy, he might call the cops on me.
Oh.
He might surreptitiously, just call in the judges.
If I don't literally have a knife in his belly button, he might try to do a code word or, Yeah.
Because if you look at him, and man, his appearance is, like you said, you can't even recognize him in this movie. But if you look at his forehead, he's got a tattoo on it that says mole. And if you look at those flashbacks, those torture flashbacks that we get every once in a while showing how nasty Mama is, it's him that she's gouging the eyes out of.
Yeah.
That's why
he
has these cybernetic eyes. So I think what's happened here is he's a captive. Like, he's a captive tech. They found him for some reason, like, infiltrating their operation. Maybe he was in another gang or something. And they tattooed Mole on his head, and they gouged out his eyes, and they made him their tech bitch, essentially.
They're just using him.
And so they have to keep a close eye on him, yeah.
Yeah.
We'll be right back with more Bald Move after this brief pause.
Commission podcasts are an awesome feature here at Bald Move that allows you, the individual listener, to decide what we talk about for a single podcast.
The community loves it because it often leads to fun, fan favorite films and TV shows that we've overlooked getting the coverage they deserve.
And we love it because we're constantly exposed to great stuff that's not even on our radar.
The way it works is simple. You go to support.baldmove.com and you click on commissions. Then you pay the flat rate for the commission and tell us what two-ish hours of content you'd like us to make podcasts on.
Then we'll contact you for details, advanced feedback, and any dedications you'd like to make.
Then we watch the thing, discuss the thing, turn it into a podcast, and pump it right into your ears.
We get consistently great feedback on how much our commissioners love their podcast, and they make great gifts for the dedicated Bald Move fan in your life.
And who knows, that dedicated fan could even be you. Treat yourself. Check out support.baldmove.com for more info.
You've been listening to quite a few Bald Move podcasts now, but you're not in the club? Whoo boy, you are missing out.
Not only are all of our premium club podcast feeds completely ad-free, but we have lots of other great content exclusively for people in the club.
There's a weekly lunch with Jim and Aaron where we chat with fans about anything and everything from TV and films, food, fun, life advice, and more.
But there's also Off the Clock, our premium podcast where we talk about all the shows we don't have time for on our public feeds.
Plus, you get access to our full spoiler-filled first-run movie reviews of our newly released films.
Don't forget Instant Take and Talk podcast, where we give our hot takes and discuss television shows with our fans live and immediately after the episode airs.
With mega shows like House of the Dragon coming this summer, we're going to have lots to talk about.
Not to mention access to our fun and friendly community of club members, with exclusive Discord channels and a dedicated forum. It's one of the best places on the internet to hang out and chat about pop culture.
Bottom line, you're helping two regular type guys in the Midwest make the content you like to listen to, which some would say is rewarding to itself.
Help keep the lights on and the bits flowing at Bald Move.
And get some awesome content for yourself. Head to support.baldmove.com to join the club today.
Since the dawn of time, we've been putting clothes on our back that identify us with our people, our group, our tribe.
And while Bald Move might be one of the smallest, weirdest tribes out there, transcending all concepts of border, class, culture, and creed, we still have respect for the old ways.
At support.baldmove.com, you can get t-shirts, hats, mugs, and more. We have something for every one of our podcasts, or just wear the four pips of the Bald Move logo with pride.
Bald Move merch beats running around naked, and they make a great gift for the Bald Move fan in your life. Join our tribe! Head over to support.baldmove.com and click on merch to start shopping.
And now, back with more Bald Move.
The one false note I have about the movie is Judge Dredd telling Rex to wait. Or Lex, rather.
Oh.
I know they lampshade it.
They do a pretty good job lampshading it.
Too much, but it's still really fucking dumb. It's just dumb. It's dumb. It's dumb.
Yeah.
Like, if they were going to do that, I think they should have shortened it. They shouldn't have tried to lampshade it. He should have said, wait. And then Lex should have been like, you think I'm going to fall for that, Dredd? And then his head just explodes. And he's like, nope. He could say something else badass. Yeah. But, like, that's the one scene that I think has not aged well and was never that good to begin with.
Okay, I mean that's fair. It is lampshaded pretty hard, but I the thing I like about that scene, I guess, is the corrupt judge's image of Dredd not matching up with the thing that's happening here. I kind of like that part of it where he's all he can do is laugh because this is the ferocious, the feared, the lauded Judge Dredd,
and he thinks he's got
yeah.
And he's got him dead to rights.
Uh huh.
Yeah. He's gonna try.
I kind of like that sentiment, but you're right. It's a bit much.
Yeah. And like I said, it comes very close to working, but it's just something about it that's too long or kind of too clever or too like, I know this is a trope, but wait, I got a twist on it. And
yeah.
It doesn't quite pull off. And it's also that like caps off one of the best action sequences. Mm-hmm. You know? It's like imagine if fucking Arnold did that at the end of Predator. You know, it's like, you know, it's like instead of come get me, he's like, wait. And the Predator's like, rah, 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 ugly motherfucker. And then the Latino woman comes up and kills the Predator. It's like, what?
Yeah, I forget where they are. But yes. Yeah, that would be kind of silly.
And I don't mind Anderson being the one to kill. It's just yeah, I don't know. Little tropey for me.
Yeah, I feel you. How about so there's a lot of good dialogue in here, you know, even if that part of it is tropey, there's the stuff about the meat grinder, like you said, that's really great. I really love when Judge Dredd throws Mama off and she splatters below and you see the signal die off, the building doesn't explode. He looks down 200 stories above and just says, yeah.
Yeah, I almost wish that he didn't say anything. He just kind of grimly nodded like, yeah, I knew I was right.
Oh, speaking of, you touched on it, but I got to give it to him. When they fire off those miniguns, uh-huh, and then he comes out of that smoke-filled hallway with one of their dudes, walks out onto the balcony, tosses him off, looks at him across the way, and then just turns around and strolls back in.
Yeah.
Bad. I cannot tell you how badass that was.
Especially from Mama's perspective, because he's walking out of literal hell. Like, there's no place a human body could have possibly hidden. And not only that, he's got her number one man.
Yep.
And throws him right off the balcony. Like, you're taking out the trash. It's such a great moment.
Yeah. God, that's
good. I mentioned this, like, some of the times where it's like, you know, Carl Urban's got this resting Dredd face. It's like he's got this like permanent grimace at all times. It's perfect. But every once in a while, it like hardens even further. And my favorite moment is when the med tech is saying, like, you're not going to make it out of here. You're already dead. And like the camera tilts like 18 inches lower. It kind of slowly zooms. Somehow the scowl deepens and that's just metal guitar riff hits. It's nice. So good. It's such a great way to end the first act of the movie.
My favorite deep Dredd face is when he gets shot near the end. The judge shoots him through the wall and he slumps down, and the frown he is making cannot be described. It has to be seen.
Yeah, there's like a full-on snarl.
Which makes him like a really good stand-in for Stallone. I like, as someone who's not coming to it from the comics, just from that original movie, I feel like he nails the Stallone part of that.
I do too. Yeah, because Stallone's ego is too big to properly make a Judge Dredd film. See him taking his helmet off all the fucking time.
Right.
Whereas Urban didn't have that. He was just there to service the character.
Yeah. He's the guy who'd been in Lord of the Rings, for God's sake. You know, he doesn't need to show his face on camera. His name is enough.
Yeah. I really like, he's got so many great lines about, I think this is another one where he's talking to the judge, or the Judge Dredd is talking to the med tech or something. And he's like, you know how often we get a judge in Peachtree? And Judge Dredd says, well, you got one now. And then his response to, Anderson, you know, he's like, you know what, it's like, regulation says you wear a helmet all the time, which is what interferes with my psychic ability. And he's like, I think a bullet would interfere more. I love that line.
Yep, good stuff.
I'm trying to think. I know there's a couple others he has. There's another good, like, intensified dread face when he's doing that long address to Peachtree. It's like, you know, mama's not the law, I am the law, she's a common criminal. And then he says, as for you, mama, judgment time. And I think they hit us with another metal riff, and he snarls again.
Yeah, I like the moment when he tells that the homeless junkie, right, who will debase himself for credits, like, don't be here when we get back.
Right.
And they get back, and he is there, and he's, you're going to the ISO cubes, and he could just get smashed by the blast door.
Yeah, and I also like the bookend where, you know, when they first go in the Peachtree and they're about to get into, like, a fur ball, he's like, are you ready? And she's like, yeah. He's like, you don't look ready. But then right when they're going to do the final storming of Mama, he's like, are you ready? She's like, I'm ready. And he's like, you look ready. And it's it's such a great, because she goes through a lot of growth and change through the movie, too.
Oh, yeah. I think maybe more than Dread, even.
Sure, yeah. But it's like, what would you say her arc is?
Someone who naively thinks that she can help everybody, probably. She can run in here and help all of her former neighbors, to someone who realizes that you do the best you can, I guess. She's not going to solve the problems here, but she can contribute to making it a little more pleasant for people.
Yeah, I feel like... Because there's also, you know, there's also a lot of anti-mutant stuff scattered through, you know, like there's no muti graffiti and things like that. There's a couple other, you know, political signs and stuff that imply that a person like her is probably judged pretty harshly in the world. And she's got this kind of inferiority complex where she's not quite sharp enough. She's not quite fast enough. She's a couple points underneath the judge standards, but they're letting her slide just because she's got this freakish ability. And like, there's a change that comes over, like, once she finally fails, she loses her weapon, she's like, well, I'm not going to be a judge anyway. That's like when she learns to quit worrying about that and the performance and just kind of goes with the flow. That's when she succeeds. I think that's it too, like when she stops caring about being a judge and just judging, I guess.
Yeah, totally. And a lot of my, I guess, assessment of her is assuming that she's going to take the judge job, because she ends the movie at a place where, like, she's kind of done with it, right? She hands her badge over, says, yeah, I'm obviously failed, I'm out of here, and she walks away. But I assume she's going to take the job once she gets it, like once she realizes, oh, I actually passed.
I think so. That's every time I get to, let's talk about this big picture stuff too. Every time I get to the end of the movie and I get to that point where she's clearly walking off, where and she's going to make, I think it's such a criminal offense. Like, I will put this up with Firefly Season 2, Master and Commander 2. The fact that we didn't get Dread 2 is a goddamn crime. Because they set up a lot of stuff where, like, Anderson's kind of scrutinizing, like, Judge Dread psychically. And she kind of has, like, there's something... that they kind of like tease a secret about Dread, that, you know, there's something inside him that they kind of cut off. That's a little bit of fodder for a sequel. And then the way that character ends up where she's a full judge, but she doesn't know it yet. And every time I see Carl Urban in The Boys, I'm like, it's not too late. It's not too late. He can shave the beard, throw on the helmet, put on the Kevlar. He'll look just as cool. We got 5 to 10 years of prime Urban that we can make another Dread. Come on. Can we not? Garland? Are you getting in the way of this? Are you too busy with your Civil War bullshit? Let's do Dread.
People might know this, but in our Baldi's Awards, which are coming out here pretty soon, the beginning of March, over in our Prestige feed, we do a category where we give an award to the highest risk movie and the highest reward movie. It's highest risk, highest reward, which means basically you didn't need to make a sequel to this thing. It was beloved already. You decided you were going to do it anyway, and you nailed it. That's what that category is.
Yeah.
I would be afraid that a sequel to this movie would lose that category. It would be in the category, and we would say, nope, they completely fucked it up, or in our biggest disappointment category, because... and this movie is so perfect, I am terrified that they would have made a sequel and just completely screwed it up. If you don't have Alex Garland involved, if he's off doing, you know, some other sci-fi show. Like, I would only want it with him.
And Carl Urban as Dredd. Like, anything else I would consider a completely new property, unless you had Garland and Urban involved.
And I like Thurlby, too. She's very good in this.
She's good.
So bring her back as Cassandra.
I'm not sure why she hasn't done much.
Maybe I'm just not watching the stuff she does. I don't know.
Also, this movie was not a success when it came out.
It barely made
its budget back, which was considered a failure at the time. And it didn't take long. Like, I remember, like, it was just within a year or two, this movie kind of got catapulted to, like, you know, this is, and now I think it's properly rated. Everyone knows that, like, Dredd is cool. And if you don't, now you do, because you listen to the podcast. Would it even be eligible for highest risk, highest reward? Because it's like, of course you should make a sequel, you know, to this.
I don't know. It's
that you can
feel
still
like
fuck it up and it would be biggest disappointment, but I don't know. Yeah. It's like, how risky, and unless they reboot it, like they wait another 10 years and they go without Garland and they completely,
well, I guess that's fair. Part of it. Yeah, the highest risk part is usually it was beloved by everybody, but it is at this point. Like, okay, it didn't make $1 billion, but it is a cult classic at this point.
And it doesn't have an obvious hook for a sequel. Like, there's
it doesn't need,
I mean,
one
there's definitely
at
hooks,
all.
But it's not like there's an open question that's asked.
This is not like Ghost Protocol Part 1, which is now Ghost Protocol.
Yeah, or whatever. Uh-huh. Yeah.
So I don't know if they did it. I would want them to treat it with some respect, but
yeah,
who knows if that would happen.
Too late, man. As soon as Carl Urban gets done with The Boys, I hope Garland gets free of his project and they can come together and do it, because it would be pretty nice. It'd be pretty nice. Let's talk about the directorial scandal.
Oh yeah.
So I had dimly been aware of this, because every time Alex Garland does something, I notice a Dredd gets it, because, you know, he wrote this thing too, but, like, increasingly he's seen as the director. This is very much like a Rogue One situation where, you know, supposedly one guy directed it, and then behind the scenes, kind of, sort of, some other guy took it and did a lot of camera B, might even have taken over after the original director was fired, edited, released it. This seems like Pete Travis shot 100% of the movie.
Mm-hmm.
And then over creative differences during the editing process, he got locked out of the room. They brought in Alex Garland to finish the cut of the film.
Mm-hmm.
And people argue that Alex Garland should get a direct... Now, I don't understand how credits work in Hollywood exactly, but how in the world would him finishing the editing, even if he did the editing from start to finish... How would he possibly get sole director credit? I don't even think co-director credit. He might get editing credit.
Yeah,
but
definitely
how would he get
sole.
Why would he get director's credit? And I read a Carl Urban interview in 2018, yeah. I think it was a Comic-Con thing, where he said that he considers this Alex Garland's first film and he wished he got director credit and all that. But, like, and I think he was on the set a lot as a
That's
writer,
what I think
kind of
it
consulting
was.
And things, but...
Yeah,
I haven't seen anyone actually say he was, you know, getting behind the camera and he was telling the director of cinematography to do this and do that. And he was saying, oh, Carl, you should snarl 5% more. I don't know. Like, it's weird that Pete Travis shot 100% of the film. No one disputes that. And yet there's this asterisk by his name. It's weird.
Yeah, I can see things getting blurry, though, with a writer on site who had, like, a creative vision for it, you know. Alex Garland, I think, as is evidenced by his later works where he did direct, has a strong vision for what he wants to see on screen.
Yeah.
You look at, you know, Devs. I mean, there's clearly a creative vision behind that. I could see him being the kind of writer who's in there, and when Carl Urban needs some advice on how to pull this scene off, he's standing right beside the director saying, yeah, this is how I envisioned it. Or when they're doing the slow-mo scenes, like, this is what I had in my head. And then the director just kind of translates what he's thinking. Yeah, there's a co-director kind of vibe to that. But then the interesting thing to me is they came out with a joint statement later, him and the director,
mm-hmm.
that said, yeah, we had an arrangement that was sort of non-traditional in the sense of director writer splits. But we both agree that he's a director and I'm the writer. So they themselves, like even Alex Garland is not pushing for, yeah, I'm the director of this movie. He very much wants it to be, no, this other guy directed it.
Yeah, but I see a statement like that in Hollywood and I think it's bullshit. You know, this was some money exchanged hands, some NDAs were signed, and for the good of the movie and the publicity, sure, we're unified behind this. But that's not a statement of the truth.
Yeah, but I mean, look, the story's out there. You know, yeah, he probably was advising in some capacity on.
But that's the thing, is like we're saying, it's been 12 years. Why haven't we heard that? Like, oh, actually, because like you hear when like Tombstone, right? That's one of those Cosmopolis movies. You hear that? It's like, well, Kurt Russell stealth directed that. He was writing dialogue for Val Kilmer. He was taking control of directorial units and like going out in the scene and like, you know, saying put the camera here. That sounds like a guy who actually stealth directed a movie. I never heard a firsthand account of anyone saying that he was that on the set. And that's what I'm saying. Like, I just need one person to say he was behind the camera. You know, like
Carl Urban said, I consider him the director. You know, and so it's,
yeah, but why? Just because he's your friend and it was a really good movie
I mean, it's messy. I can imagine that's super messy on a set. Like, because Carl Urban, it says, oh yeah, I ad-libbed a bunch of lines. I worked with you know, the writer on the dialogue. Why doesn't he get a co-writing credit?
Right.
If he made up lines, why doesn't he get a co-writing credit? You know, it's just messy. It's a really tricky process.
I honestly think the reason that we haven't got any better evidence is because of that statement. That statement does scream NDAs, money changing hands.
Possibly,
and like, yeah, it would probably, like, whereas Cosmopolis, I don't think he'd get, like, first of all, he's dead, right? So
I think so.
And also, like, it's like our opinion after we've seen his work is that he's kind of like hired to do this, to be the
fig
leaf
thing. Yeah.
Yeah, like an actor wants to try directing, but he can't get the producers to put up the cut. Oh, you get Cosmopolis. Is that his name?
It's the father of the guy who directed Mandy, who.
Yes.
I can't remember his name.
And he's got a whole history of being the putative directors of films that got, like, for example, wasn't he used on Rambo?
It's Stallone. Cosmatos. I don't know how you say it. I think it's George. Yeah,
the back in the 80s or 90s, if you wanted to kind of spread your wings as a director, you hired George and he would show up and, you know, get the attaboy and be helpful and just kind of be a real director in case the studio got scared.
That's so weird that you can be a job without actually doing the thing you're paid to do.
Yeah.
Like, he just got paid to put his name on movies.
Yeah.
Or I guess he got paid to show up and probably like try and direct, but then people directed. I don't know.
Well, that's to say, because like I've seen people like Kevin Costner, that's his move, right? He goes on as a actor and he just takes over. I think that this was much more, you know, but we got a joint statement. So they're essentially forced to play nice and there's probably legal repercussions for anyone but Carl Urban. And even Carl Urban, maybe he got, you know, rebuked for this, but. As recent as 2018, they were all talking about getting the band together and doing it. That was only 6 years ago. So,
I mean, it would be cool if they can do it right. I'm just scared that they'll mess it up. Because I really do feel like this is all the stars aligned, like perfect plot, perfect actors, perfect direction, perfect effects. Mm-hmm. It just all came together. And to do it again seems like a tricky thing.
Yeah, and they found a story that kind of is a one shot. I think that's really important because, yeah, I don't know how you do some of the. That's the other problem they tried to do in the original Dread is this is like, you know, like that's the Dark Phoenix saga of Judge Dredd, you know, his clone brother and all this family drive. Like they tried to jump right into something that you need a firm foundation of lore, the character, the universe, but where they could keep doing these one off shots all day long. That's I think the charm of the Master and Commander movies too, is like they're kind of all very loosely connected. You could do them in almost any order, and you can change the names and dates and nationalities involved as the belligerents, and it wouldn't really matter.
This time, they're stuck at the top of a tower, and they have to get to the bottom.
They have to shoot their way down, yeah.
Yep. Go the fast way, or you can take the stairs.
What else? What else you got to talk about with Dredge? Dredd? It's just Dredd.
I'm a stickler for rules, so I want to see how many of the rules they broke. Because there are three things that are automatic fails in this movie. First one is incorrect sentencing. Second one is disobeying a direct order from your assessment officer. The third one is losing your primary weapon or having it taken from you. The third one, she definitely had happen to her. She points it out herself. Mm-hmm. Did she ever incorrectly sentence anybody or disobey a direct order from Dredd?
Let me ask you another question. Did Judge Dredd ever actually issue her an order?
I don't think so.
I don't think so either.
Yes.
So
yes. One time he told her, and I don't know if this constitutes an order, if you have to say that's a direct order, but he tells her to take Kay and go to the elevator and post up there. That's the only time he ever tells her what to do at all.
Yeah, that's what it's so. And she
when
did
they get locked
that,
in that
so,
cage kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah.
And she did, yeah. So she didn't disobey
that
order.
That was my take. He was letting her roll with everything, so she couldn't really disobey any orders. And then incorrectly sentenced. I think that's why he asked her the one time, and she said, no, he's a victim, not a perp. And now, she didn't elaborate, but by that point in the movie, I think he trusted her that she could kill somebody if she had to. She wasn't being weak. She used her powers that are real, he believes in, to determine this. And, Domhnall Gleeson just is wretched in this movie. He's like a Gollum version of himself.
Yeah, totally. So I think she only, broke the one rule or got one fail. But I think that's it.
All right, let's wrap it up. Wrap one of the finest action movies ever made. If you've made it this far and you haven't seen it, shame on you. Go watch it now. I don't think it's a free download anywhere. I certainly had to rent it.
Oh, did you? It's on Netflix right now till the end of February.
Ah, damn.
That's
it.
Where I watched it.
Why did not show up in my where it's on viewer? But anyway, yeah. So it's now you got zero excuse because I know most of you people have Netflix. Go watch it. That's going to be it for us this week for Judge or our Dredd podcast. We are going to take a little bit of a break from the retro movie coverage because it's the best of times. It's the worst of times when it comes to prestige and pulp. It's the best of times because we're about to start watching Shogun, which is a highly regarded novel, as well as already been successfully adapted to a TV miniseries. FX Hulu is taking another run on it. It looks phenomenal, and I've heard nothing but good things about it. And it's the worst of times because Rick and Michonne, the ones who live, are making us go back to The Walking Dead on Bald Move Pulp for 6 weeks. Maybe a 6 weeks plus 6 weeks engagement because we might, depending on how badly we're beat up by Rick and Michonne, we might go on to Negan and Maggie. Well, we'll see. We might go on to Dead City. City of the Dead, I can't remember. Eventually we'll when we get the run and dry and Pulp and Prestige, we'll be back at it. Thank you to our executive producers that selected Dredd from the suite of movies that we nominated for coverage, and we'll get back to that as soon as like I said we get to the hard bottom of the Pulp and the Prestige barrels. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time, again, either watching Shogun or The Walking Dead. Until then, I'm Aaron
and I'm Jim.
See ya.